Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories.
Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom. And for those of you who remember my buddy Adam coming on the show, Adam was the officer that I'd worked with early on in my career, who then went on to a different department in Central California and was shot four times at close range with a 357 Magnum. Well, Adam is unable to be here. He was trying to join us. However, he did bring with him, and now it's just the two of us, his buddy, Jay. How are you, Jay?
I'm doing well. About yourself?
Oh, you know, I could complain, but, you know, nobody would care, right? So Adam was going to join us, but unfortunately, due to scheduling conflicts, we have those a lot recently. Adam won't be here, but we do have Jay. Now, Jay, you and Adam work on the same department. Is that correct?
We did up until last month. I just retired January 6th of 2021.
Congratulations.
Hey, thanks.
My old man used to say he was in his, you know, first year of recovery from the police department, his second year of recovery.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. That's how he tracked retirement, was like an alcoholic in recovery. So congratulations on the retirement. You are then willing to be here and be with us. So why don't you tell us when you came on, what kind of your background was to get onto the department, what you did when you were there.
Okay. Yeah. So I started my career in 1997. I initially worked at the Tulare County Sheriff's Office. There I was assigned to the custody division. Obviously hated every day of it. I felt like I was locked up. And then I came over to Visalia PD in 1998. During my time at that department, I initially did 3 years in patrol. I was a firearms instructor. I was a field training officer. I was on a tactical team. From there, I transferred to the schools. So I was a school resource officer for a couple years. Did the worst thing you could ever do, did a good job, got police officer of the year, and got kicked to the gang unit for the next 3 years. did 3 years in gangs, and then I got to do a fourth year in a countywide gang task force. From there, I went back to patrol for a few years. I finished up my education. I hold a bachelor's of science in criminal justice management. From there, I transferred back to the schools for 2 years. I worked at a high school, very busy. I arrested about 300 kids in 2 years. And I mean, that's handcuffs booked on the way to juvenile hall.
Yeah, people in other states that aren't California, maybe you don't understand. Some high schools in certain towns, Stockton, Visalia, parts of Los Angeles, parts of Oakland, you're going to be busy if you worked at school.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know what? I had like 1900 kids, you know, it's like a small city.
Yeah.
And you know, you have a lot of fighting, drugs, weapons, theft. I mean, I did investigate a lot of sex crimes.
Oh yeah. God. And then not to mention the added, because we give school resource officers a lot of crap on this show.
For sure.
Cause you and I both know there's a lot of people that hide out in that job.
For sure.
Just doing puppet shows. So I was trying to explain, like when John was a school cop, you know, John was not your typical school cop. John was out on patrol pulling over dopers. There's two different kinds. There's the kinds that go to make shadow puppets and, you know, bring the dog for the, you know, petting zoo, school resource officers. And then there's the ones that are basically occupying force at a high school where they're the only thing that's keeping.
Yeah, not the truth. Mm,
yeah, it's kind of
also
weird.
Too. You know this, man. It's like people don't realize how a school campus is now. You know, it's always in the back of your mind. You might have an active shooter situation. I arrested numerous parents. You know, and people don't get it. I mean, my first 3 weeks on the job, I ended up at the school. I had to end up tasing a kid. Well, on the media that night, you know, officer chases child. Well, they don't put that the child is 17 years old and weighs 200 pounds.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I got to do 2 years in the schools at a high school, which was awesome. And then I went to a place called commercial policing, which I handled a major business district in the city of Visalia that has hundreds of stores. I was arresting about 300 people per year in this business district. You know, a lot of embezzlement, petty theft. Back when, you know, petty theft was
right, you could actually go to jail
over the 400 bucks.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I was so busy. And then I did about, I went back to patrol after doing that for 4 years. And I did about 3.5 years back at patrol, got a wild hair and went and transferred to the San Luis Obispo Police Department. I was there for about 6 months. I could tell
what
you
year was that?
That was 2016.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Cause I had retired from Atascadero PD in 2013. So we basically just missed each other.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you this, a lot of great guys at the department. I just don't know how anybody does law enforcement on the Central Coast. Far too liberal for me, man. But you know what? I had a great experience. A lot of great guys. It's a great department. It's just a rough area. And you know, coming from a department, Visalia PD is very aggressive. Slow PD, not so much. You know,
well, they go to party calls and take rocks and bottles voluntarily because the politics of working in a college town means the rich mommy and daddy tell the police not to be mean to little Susie and little Billy.
That is totally true. And, you know, I just told myself, hey, you know what? I'm going to go back to Visalia. So, you know, you never burn a bridge because you may have to walk across it. So when I left Visalia to go to SLO, I already had like 18 years on, you know, at Visalia. And so they let me come back. I did about a year back at patrol. And then, believe it or not, I got to finish back at that original high school as a school resource officer. And, you know, and a lot of that, too, is my personality. I've been blessed with something a lot of cops don't have. It's called a personality. You know what I mean? And so I got to do that. And then I retired January 6, 2021, the day I turned 50.
There you go.
And now, believe it or not, I'm doing private investigations. I'm already working for a company. And I'm doing that just to pay for my medical because the city of Visalia does not provide health care for retirees. And so to stay on it, you got to go to Cobra, which is $2,100 a month.
Yeah, exactly. So that there goes that, you know, big healthy chunk of that retirement.
For sure.
Right. So, Jay, you've obviously run the gamut from gangs to school resource, which in some cases in Visalia, it's the same thing.
It totally is.
The floor is yours, man. What's your story?
You know what? I can tell you this, just to piggyback with Adam's situation. I can tell you this, Adam is a stud, man. Anybody that takes four hot ones for the company and is still coming back to work and working, I have nothing but the utmost respect for Adam.
Yep.
You know, a lot of people, I think that just would have retired him out and they'd have been done. And, you know, that speaks a lot to Adam's thing. You know, I had to go through an officer involved shooting during my career. I've witnessed probably another five of them where I was probably, you know, 3 to 4 feet away when another one of my partners I had to be in an officer involved shooting. It's just a crazy job, you know, and I'm thankful that I got to do my 23 years and come out unscathed. Never got arrested, never got prosecuted, never got sued.
Right.
You know what I mean? So
right.
I'm very thankful. I had a great career. And I can tell you this, probably one of my best stories of being a cop is this. I'll never forget it. January 2005, me and my partner, we'd gone to the academy together. We're cruising around and I said, hey, man, wouldn't it be great if we got into like a car chase down to Delano? Well, that's like 35 miles from
us. Right.
You know what I mean? That's a good
that's a whole other city.
Yeah. And he goes, yeah, it would, man. He goes, it'll never happen. I mean, 1 hour later, you want to talk about like basically prophetic is we get sent to an audible burglar alarm. Right.
Right.
And then it transfers to a holdup alarm at a bank. Right. Now, you know, this 99.9% of the time, those are false.
Right.
So, you know, we're not driving lights and sirens. We're taking our time. I'm driving. One thing I can do is I can drive. And so as we're getting close, now we get update info. Three suspects just exited the bank carrying guns. The bank's now been robbed. Yeah. And so now we're kicking
at a whole different level.
Yeah. Now we're at 100 miles an hour trying to get there.
Yeah, most people don't understand 95% of all bank, all burglar alarms, all silent alarms, all holdup alarms, it's get there, set up a perimeter, call inside the business, and they go, oh, I'm sorry, Susie tripped it. I didn't realize.
Correct.
Okay, Susie's coming out. She's wearing blue pants and a red shirt, blah, 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 blah. And then everybody goes up, okay, please don't do that again. And then we all have to try and take the adrenaline dump down because we were ready for it to be real.
That is totally true. And you know this, it's law enforcement. You know, the average person is really, it's 90% boredom, 10% sure terror, right?
Right, right. I heard it was like being an airline pilot. Hours and hours and hours of boredom punctuated by seconds of ass-puckering terror.
Correct. And so now we get on to a pursuit with these guys, and, you know, they're just blowing through intersections. Well, you know, we can't do that because if we T-bone a car, we kill everybody. You know, now we've incurred the civil liability.
Yeah, I don't care what Eddie Murphy says in Beverly Hills Cop and all this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. So now we finally get on the freeway, and now we are in our chase on the way to Delano, right? And we're going like 135 miles an hour, but I was in the gang unit, so I'm in a blacked out Crown Vic. It's got just a forward red light that's right by the rearview mirror, and it's got wigwags in the back. And
so now this is actually more dangerous for you.
Oh, big time.
You guys don't understand. If you don't have the comfort of a black and white car with red and blue cherries on top, it's dangerous.
It totally is. And now we're on the freeway. And I remember when we're getting on the freeway, I tell my partner, I go, get on the radio, tell them that we're southbound on the 99. Well, he's so pumped that he grabs the mic, keys it up. He doesn't say anything. So I finally grab it and I go, dude, give me that thing before you have a seizure. I get on the radio, tell dispatch, you know, direction and all that. And people wouldn't get out of our way. I mean, literally, you know, because John Q. Citizen is driving, got the radio going, they're on their phones, they're just not paying attention.
Right.
So I'm literally coming up on cars going 135 miles an hour that are going 70.
Right.
So finally we get down to the city of Tulare, I was born and raised in that town. And that's about 10 miles south of Visalia. And they tried to get off the freeway. I knew that that was a hairpin curve. They didn't know it. And they hit that thing going 100 miles an hour. It launched their car about 8 feet in there. It was like Dukes of Hazzard. Hey, dude, it was fucking awesome to watch, dude. So the car lands, we come skidding up, we jump out, go to guns, and they take off running, and they jump a chain link fence. So they're on one line and I'm on the other. The center guy spins around, and I lit him up, man. I dropped him twice right in the middle of the freeway, man, shot him. And I'll never forget, I remember thinking he's going to get ran over by traffic. So I had to get on the radio.
Which doesn't that seem like an odd thought for somebody you just shot?
Correct. Yeah. You're thinking, if he gets ran over, that's not going to look good. Yeah.
Right. It's like, I can shoot you, but you can't get run over.
Yeah.
You know how much trouble I'm going to be in if I let you get run over after I shoot you?
Correct.
Because the headline is going to be, officer shoots man, leaves him in the street to die being run over by a truck.
That's totally true. And I remember I got on the radio and I was like, block off the freeway. One of my partners blocked it off. And so my partner comes up and he goes, Jay, jump the fence and cuff him. I said, hey, man, I just shot this motherfucker. You jumped the fence. And so he does, but it's a chain link fence, but it didn't have the top bar.
Right.
So the top of the fence is kind of, you know, like this.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He gets up there. He goes, Jay, help. I put my gun in my left hand, grabbed him by the butt, pushed him over the fence. He landed on the ground next to one of the suspects. There were three suspects in the car. So we finally get everybody in custody, and the guy I shot was actually on parole for bank robbery.
Aww.
And interesting, you know, this is where you kind of really understand how everything is connected, right? His parole agent was assigned to Fresno. A year, two years later, that parole agent became my partner in the gang task force, and we had never met prior to that. So,
law enforcement is a small world.
No, it's totally, it totally is. And I'm going to tell you this, I was very fortunate, and people don't realize the stress of an officer involved shooting. And, you know, even now to this day, you know, you still think about it, but it's a scary, scary thing because, you know, they take your gun, draw your blood, read you your rights. Yeah. And, I had a great lawyer. She, you know, and if anybody listened to this podcast, I would say this. If you're ever involved in an officer-involved shooting, wait 24 hours before you give a statement. Because I can tell you this. I remembered 1,000 things more the next day, you know. Right.
Give your public safety statement.
Yeah. You know, I've shot in this direction. Yep.
Three of them. No, I was just saying there's three of them. I think I fired this many rounds. I got this guy. They're so-and-so outstanding. Are you okay? Yes, I'm fine. Okay.
Yeah.
That's it.
And you know, what was interesting too is, you know, my first couple shots, I remember thinking I couldn't hear the gun going off. Okay.
Yeah, right.
And I really thought my gun was misfiring. And the only way that I finally realized that it was working was I could feel the recoil and I could see my sights jumping, but I couldn't hear it. So my hearing shut down.
Right. Auditory exclusion.
Oh, big time. And then another thing too was, I remember they're like, hey, how many shots did you fire? And I was like, 4 to 6. I fired 8 and didn't even know it.
Right.
And you know, that's another thing that people don't realize is in the whole final analysis of all of it, you know, it's sensory overload. You got right. So much going on.
Your brain has to decide what it actually wants to retain because it's never going to retain. It's now functioning at such a high level, but it's unable to actually like put those things down onto paper. It's, you know, cannot write to the hard drive.
Yeah. And, you know, and then obviously, you know, I remember that the DA's office came and interviewed me. What's great about that, the guy that interviewed me, he became one of my partners in the gang task force a couple years later, and he had worked for VISA previously. So, I mean, I was treated with dignity and respect, but at the end, it's just, you know, and then you go home for a week and then you got to go see the psychologist and all that. And I remember the psychologist is like, Jay, do you have guilt or are you okay? You know, are you sleeping well? And I said, hey, doc, I don't see green monsters in my sleep. I said, I'm good to go. You know what I mean?
Right. And sometimes that's absolutely the case. And you're kind of afraid to tell them, no, I'm good. Because you want to feel, well, I'm having a little, you want to sound like you have remorse and you'd hated taking another human being's life and da, 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 because they're going to think you're a sociopath or a psychopath if you don't. But sometimes when somebody tries to kill you and you have to kill them, it's a business transaction.
Well, and you know what? At the end of the day, I got lucky. My guy lived. You know, he's back in prison forever. But you know what? What's funny is I was just watching the movie The Departed. And one of the things that Matt Damon tells the psychologist, you know, guys want to come in your office and they want to cry and moan and complain saying, hey, you know, I had to shoot somebody. Hey, you know what? None of us want to have to do that. But right. If it's you or them, that's really no choice at all.
Right.
You
know, they took the choice away from you.
For sure. And what was funny that night, so they get the suspect to the hospital and the guy that's guarding him was one of my buddies. And he calls me, goes, Jay, the guy he shot, he's like the nicest guy. He's so respectful. I go, that's not what I want to hear. I want to hear that he was a mad dog. Right. You know what I mean? And, But, you know, he ended up, in fact, I didn't even have to go to court. They just pled out and they took the 25 to life each and moved on with their lives. And, yeah. And you know, and then the psychologist goes, hey, when do you want to go back to the work? I go, give me the weekend off and I'll be back on Monday. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And it, like you said, you are fortunate that your suspect lived and they did, because that's like as easy as it gets. You know, they're going to sue you. They're going to tell you they're permanently disabled. They're going to do, you know, go to all these things when in reality, there used to be a class of criminal that was, no, I fought with the cops and I got shot and now I'm doing my time.
Yeah.
And that's like, it's just the cost of doing business.
Well, you know? Too. And I shot somebody that happened to be black. You know, and think about if we had transferred to now,
right?
What type of scrutiny would there be? You know, right. And even though he's on parole, even though he robbed a bank, there is a whole part of society right now that would be like, Jay's the suspect.
Well, and here's the thing. I guarantee you in this entire story, Like we said, your brain only remembers the parts that matter, right? It has to decide. And now as we're sitting and talking about it, you're all, oh yeah, by the way, the guy I shot was black, which shows you how low on your priority list the guy's race actually was, is because it has no part of the story. It's not germane to the issue, which means it was the last thing you were thinking about.
It was. And you know, it's like, I remember, you know, and I've had the benefit of growing up in bad neighborhoods. You know, I come from very humble beginnings. And, you know, I'm the first person in my entire family that graduated from high school, served in the military, got a bachelor's degree and got a career, not a job.
Right.
But I did all that growing up in bad neighborhoods. And, you know, so I've been exposed to all races. And you know, you're right. You know, most good cops, you know, we don't care if you're white, black, Hispanic, Asian, whatever it is. We only see this. Are you a threat or are you no threat?
Right.
Period. And you know, I look back on it and I'm thankful that it played out the way it did. None of me and my partners got hurt. And, you know, hey, we can all move on with our lives and get on down the road.
You know, it's interesting you say that because we always break people down into subcategories, right?
For sure.
And that's just human nature. I'm not talking about cops. I'm talking about, you know, we've got cops have, oh, he's a cop. He's not a cop. Oh, he's a veteran. He's not a veteran. Oh, he's a firefighter. He's not a, and you classify different people based on their life choices and stuff like that. Like I could tell you right now, I don't have to ask Jason his thoughts on repo men or, skip tracers, you know, bounty hunters.
Yeah.
I can kind of guess. Because I know Jason was a cop and he dealt with repo men and bounty hunters or skip tracers on the same way that I did. And so I could guess about where his experiences lie to, you know, based on what I know your interactions with these people would be. But what people don't maybe understand sometimes is, as a police officer, similar to the military is, are you in the military or are you not in the military? Right. For That's the first question. Then from that question come all the other questions.
That is totally true.
Right.
And you know this, and even with cops, you know, it's like this. Hey, what do you do? Oh, I'm a homicide detective, right?
Right.
So now everyone's thought process is, oh, you're the cream of the crop.
Right.
Like for me, what'd you do? I was a school resource officer. They put me right on the level as guard dog security. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it's funny because you think in your mind, you know what? Hey, I've got all the same experience. I'm investigating the same type of cases. I mean, we're not doing homicides, but, you know, we were doing a lot of sex crimes, investigating tons of those, you know, tracking runaway juveniles and all that. Hey, it's real police work.
It is.
And you're going out to bad neighborhoods where you pull up in a patrol car and people already look at you like, oh, okay, here comes the enemy. And
well, and that goes to the number one question. Like when the military asks, are they in the military or they're not? You know what? My dad obviously came up in an era where, you know, policing was a little bit like the Wild Wild West, but he said that Son, your job is to classify people into one of two categories, dipshits and assholes. There's dipshits and there's assholes. And your job is to keep them apart, because if dipshits and assholes get together, dipshits become victims and assholes become suspects.
That you know what? What agency did your dad work for?
LAPD.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So, and you got to figure, man, in the 70s and 80s, I mean, LAPD, you know, I mean, that was, well, that was the gold standard of law enforcement.
That was the Adam 12 era, because Adam 12 went on the air in 1967. It didn't go off the air until 1974. So you had this whole generation of young men and women growing up idolizing Joe Friday and Malloy from Dragnet and Adam 12. And they became that kind of a cop. But it wasn't just in LA. It was nationwide, because those TV shows were broadcast into homes all over the country, therefore creating a bunch of little Reed Malloys and a bunch of little Joe Fridays, you know? But,
well, I tell you this, interesting enough, when I got out of the military, my last day in the Navy was December 31st, 1994. Okay. And I was like, I'm going to go be a highway patrolman. So I went, I applied to the highway patrol, did an awesome job, went through that whole, and even back then, it took like 2 years to go through their testing cycle.
Oh yeah. Cause, hey, and especially for a white guy.
Oh yeah. And I'm going to tell you this, there's a reason I'm not a highway patrolman. Affirmative action got me. And they told me, they said, we have to take you from group A, drop you down to group C. And I go, well, why don't I go to the academy? And they said, maybe 3 years. Right. Well, who could wait around, you know? And hey, I tried with LAPD, but we got to remember, in 95, what were we just coming out of?
Right.
OJ, uh-huh. Right?
All the riots.
So, yeah.
They were under the consent decree, where the federal government was mandating that their hiring be 30% black, 30% white, 30% Hispanic, and 10% other. And when they're 60% white, they got a lot of people have to quit to get those numbers up.
My background investigator for LA, I'll never forget, he told me, he goes, Jay, he goes, I think you would be a great addition to LAPD. He goes, but I'm going to tell you right now, it ain't going to happen, not for a few years. Well, you know, I was lucky enough and, you know, went to the academy, did well. And, you know, I never looked back, but it was hard to hear. And, you know, nobody ever is going to say, we're not hiring you because you're white. They won't say those exact words, but it was like, hey, man, try back in a few years.
Yeah, you know, you didn't score high enough.
Correct. And I remember, you know, this, and anybody that tries to get in law enforcement, you know, you're always going to get a couple of doors slammed in your face. And it doesn't feel good. And you know what I did is, all through my career, as I've assisted so many people of trying to become a police officer, you know, and I tell people, hey, man, call me. If I can do something, point you in the right direction. You know, if you need to use me as a reference, as if I know them well enough, you know, because I remember asking people, hey, can you help me? No, I did it on my own. You do it on your own. That was rough to hear, you know?
Yeah. I was, for me, it was always, if I see the person, or if they saw me as the kind of person they'd want to work with, they'd absolutely like mentor you and talk to you and stuff like that. But you had to get yourself into a position where they could see that you were that kind of a person, whether it was, you know, your next door neighbor growing up was a cop and he's known you since you were eight. And then you go, you know, oh, you know, Mr. Smith, can you help me? Blah, blah, blah. And he's like, yeah, I know this kid. He's a good, solid kid. I'm going to help him, or something like that. There is an element of trying to keep our house in order by mentoring people who are proven commodities or are trusted commodities, or who are guys and girls that we would want to work with.
For sure.
And that's probably one of the best ways that police work can be kept, you know, above board and at its peak, is when it's kind of police officers who know what it takes to really do the job and be good at it, go out there and recruit. But the problem is when you put these blanket recruitments out there that are like, okay, we have to take 30% this race, we have to take 30% this gender, we have to do that, we have to do that. You sacrifice standards in some cases. And
I'll tell you this right now.
Anytime you sacrifice standards, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul.
For sure. I can tell you this. Visalia right now has 15 openings for police officer. Okay. You have zero people to fill those positions, you know, and then they're trying to send some people to the academy. Well, you know this, the academy 6 months and you got field training for four. So you don't even see the fruits of that labor for 10 months.
Yeah. If not a little bit extra in FTO.
Yeah.
Plus they're on probation still after they get out of FTO. So by the time you hire a police officer, let's say so the day you test, right? You test for police officer, the soonest you can expect to have a group of candidates that have conditional job offers, probably 3 to 4 months.
Oh, right? For sure.
Because you're going to have to do background investigations. You're going to have to do polygraphs. You're going to have to do medical. You're going to have to do psych, you know? And so that's 3 or 4 months, right? Then you got to wait for an academy to start. So let's say there's one starting in a month. We'll get you in that. So now you're at 4 months, 5 months, academy, 6 months. So now you're almost to a year.
Year.
Then you hit that 3 or 4 months. Well, it's 4 months. Is it 4 months minimum? I think right now.
Yeah. Vice City does 16 weeks. I don't know.
I think that's the state minimum.
Oh, yeah.
So the state minimum is 16 weeks that you have to be with a training officer. So now you're literally at about 14 months.
Yeah.
And then the guy gets out on his own, but he's still on probation. He still needs somebody to go to his calls and, get, ideas from. You're talking 3 years.
Well, and I'm going to tell you this, and then we've both seen this. Guys, they look great, sound great. You get them on the street and they ain't cutting.
No.
And VISA used to be it was a very hard agency to get hired, and it was even harder to make it through field training. It was hard to make it through probation. They have an 18-month probation now. I was lucky enough. I was still out a year. But, I can honestly say through my career, I've outlasted over a couple hundred people that I've seen come and go.
Yeah.
And that's, I have a lot of pride about that because, and I don't know if you got told this, but the day we graduated the academy, there were 44 of us. This captain from the sheriff's office walks in and he goes, if 5 of you guys from this academy make it to retirement, you'll be lucky.
Yeah.
Well, hey, brother, I was one of them. I made it. You know what I mean? I'm drawing a check. And, you look and you see so many guys that for that first 1 to 3 years were fired, got injured.
Right.
Got a DUI, got caught doing the Ike and Tina stuff with their old lady or whatever. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you see that so many guys that did not make it, and a lot of good guys. I know some great cops that just got injured, and just couldn't do the job anymore. And guys that got forced medically retired. I know some people that went out on psych leave. There's just a whole gamut of issues why people don't make it. And, luckily I work for an agency that I could retire at 50, but, to think about the new guy now has to go to 57, brother.
Is that what the age is now?
Yeah. So think about a 21-year-old kid that's got to do a 36-year career.
Yeah.
I don't know how you can do it. I really don't. I don't know. In fact, I think the wave of the future will be this. This will be a transient career. Guys will come in 5 years, 10 years, and then they'll get out.
Which is a bad idea.
It's a horrible.
Because then the only people that are going to stay in are the career people, which are usually the brass, which are usually not real cops.
Yeah, they're not out there. If my thing is this, if you're not shagging calls and taking reports, what are you really doing? Right. There's a lot of great detectives, and I work for some very cool supervisors. But there's a lot of guys that we worked with, and I know you can attest to this. There's a lot of guys, they make the room better when they leave it because they let the job chew them up, right?
Right.
And twist them up and the way that they're thinking.
And it's not that they didn't start out good.
Yes.
They let the job destroy them.
Correct. And you know what? There's a thing. I left as a slick sleeve. And a lot of that too is, I could tell you this, wasn't for lack of a trying, but a lot of times my mouth, it's like, hey, I'm one of those guys, man. If I'm going down, I'm going down swinging. And I would just say what I wanted, did what I said, it's like at the end of all of it, you just see that I always kept a good attitude. And I think it really helped me make it all those years.
Yeah.
You know, and you know this, I know you probably had some rough years in law enforcement. I did, you know, missing out on all of our, and our families end up paying the price for this job too.
Yep.
You know, I've missed so many holidays and birthdays, and, you know, I've got a 15-year-old kid, and, you know, it's trying to explain to her, you know, why I can't be there for certain things. That gets old too, you know, because our families don't sign up to be cops. You know, right. when somebody's a new cop and they would introduce them to me, hey, Jay, this is so-and-so. When I shake the cop's hand, you know what I always tell them? Welcome to the show that never ends, brother. Because this is a different beast.
Right.
You know, this is not bagging groceries. You know, this is a whole different thing.
Yep.
And I could tell people, you can watch every cop show there is, every movie, all that. It does not prepare you from when you got to go in the house, when the guy's got the gun, and it's your job to go in there and get him.
Well, you know? I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this on the show before, but I never get tired of saying it because it was a new perspective. I was at the SHOT Show.
One year,
and I met Al Mamprey, who was a medic with Easy Company in the 101st Airborne. So he was a member of the Band of Brothers.
Okay.
And if, for those of you who saw it, he was portrayed as the medic who goes running out into the field under sniper fire to heal the lieutenant, to, you know, rescue lieutenant, all that stuff. Very nice guy. And I took a picture with him and I got his autograph. And I said, you know, I just wanted to tell you, thank you. And, you know, thank you for your service. And he goes, oh, did you serve? And I said, no, I'm a police officer. And he said, oh, well, thank you. And he got all, you know, respectful. And I'm like, no, it doesn't compare. He goes, what are you talking about? He says, my deployment lasted 2 or 3 years. And then I got to come home. Your deployment lasted 20 years.
Yeah.
And I never thought about it that way, but there is it's a deployment where you get to go home at night, but you're not ever, for 20 years, you're always on the job.
That is totally, and you know what? I, one of the things I posted on my last day was this. I went to over 100,000 calls for service. I wrote over 10,000 police reports. I arrested over 3,000 suspects in my career. Okay.
Right.
That's a ton of work. And, you know, we see so much carnage in those 20 years, like for the 23 years, I got to think in my mind, how many people I've seen shot, stabbed, ran over, molested, raped, you know, swindled, all of that, you know, and you think in your mind, that's why a lot of cops become, very disgruntled, you know, very, you know, you start seeing the world through a really dark lens. And, you know, it's like you have to put it in perspective. John Q. Citizen truly has no clue of what we do.
Right. It's the 80-20 rule. We only deal with 20% of the population. We just deal with them 80% of the time.
For sure. You know, I mean, and there's a lot of good people out here. You know, it's kind of funny. About 2 hours ago, I was having breakfast in this restaurant, and it's owned by one of our dispatchers. And, you know, it's a lot of cops go there. But man, when I would walk in there in uniform, there would literally be people climbing over each other to buy my breakfast for me. And, you know, and that is great because a lot of good folks realize that this job is very, very hard.
Right.
And we really do the stuff that most people can't do for themselves or wouldn't be able to do for themselves.
No, they absolutely can't.
And, you know, people don't get it. And I Visalia is a city that I can honestly say the citizens are awesome. And, you know, but there is no utopia. You know, each city has their issues. You know, homelessness now has become the number one issue. Right. Hey, back in 06, when I was in gangs was the number one issue. Now it's homelessness.
Right.
And I really don't know how you combat that because being homeless is not illegal. That's a social issue.
Right.
Right. And
I know how we used to combat it.
Oh yeah, you put them in the car and
to the county
drive
line.
I was gonna say drive them to the next city.
Right.
And you know what was funny is I remember one of my bosses walked in one day and he goes, "Hey, that will not go on anymore." He goes, "You guys get caught doing that, you're gonna get zapped because if you really think about it, it's kidnapping." You know what I mean?
And hey, if they voluntarily go, it's not.
Yeah,
the problem we had was when two sheriff's deputies drove a guy to the county line and he was certainly fine and dandy with it. But then, you know, when they dropped him off at a gas station in the middle of nowhere and said, okay, cool, here you go. And then, so he says, fine, takes a walk down the highway and gets nailed by a car.
Yeah. Now we're in it.
Now you're in it. Right.
Yeah. And you know what? It's like most of the homeless people that we're dealing with too is in this day and age, you're dealing with people that are under the influence of illegal street drugs, alcoholism, plus mental health issues, and all three issues combined.
Right.
I don't know how you fix that, brother. You know what I mean? Because, and Visalia, unfortunately, does not have a large facility to put mental health people. So when somebody got 5150, a lot of times they were transported to Stanislaus, which is like 100 miles away, or all the way down to Vista Del Mar in Ventura.
Wow.
And the other issue too is, you know, you got a lot of bleeding heart people that think, hey, you know what, we're going to give these people money and food and, you know, all that stuff. And it's like this, if you're legitimately homeless, there's a lot of resources for you.
Right.
But what ends up happening too often than not is, you know, people just, it's like, it's rough for me to watch somebody urinate and defecate in public 5 feet from where they sleep. You know,
right.
And then the amount of trash,
especially when there's options,
there is options. And also the amount of trash that a homeless encampment can generate. Right. People don't get that. And, you know, Visalia, there's a creek. It's actually a river. It runs along the whole north side of the city. There's so much trash down there. They got to go in there with tractors.
Yeah.
Big, huge tractors to get the trash out.
Well, and I get it, right? They're homeless. They supposedly don't have anywhere to go. But like you said, there's resources. There are things out there. There are programs. There are so and you know what? There's a difference between when you see somebody who's camping, like they're legitimately homeless, like, or they're living out of their car, or they're setting up a tent every night, but they're working, they're trying to get back into place. I've seen it happen.
Oh, me too.
There's a difference between being homeless and being a homeless piece of shit.
Correct.
And you add to that these homeless encampments that are really Lord of the Flies, man. They have their own laws. They have their own rules. They don't call the cops. They just, you know, you steal, they're going to, it's prison rules. Three homeless guys are going to
beat the fuck out of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're totally right. And, you know, it's like, now, you know, I mean, it was funny. I was driving along the 99 or actually the 198 that runs through Visalia. And I'm looking on the side of the freeway and I literally counted probably 30 tents, bro. And I'm sitting there just going, you know, and I feel sorry for some people and, you know, little kids. I don't like to see that, obviously, you know, it's sad because there are resources and there's a couple of places here in town. If you're willing to walk 8 blocks, you can get 3 meals a day. There's a place here in town. If you're willing to listen to the pastor preach for an hour, they'll give you a free meal. They'll love you. They'll let you take a shower. They'll give you fresh clothes. And we would stop these people. And I would like, hey, why don't you go to the mission, you know, and get some food and get some fresh clothes. Yeah. I don't want to have nothing to do with religion. I don't know a lot, man, but if I was starving, I think listening to somebody talk for an hour and if I can get a meal and a shower and all that, I'd be willing to do it.
You know what? I'll tell you something even worse than that. Our homeless shelter for the night, you know, it was a hot and a cot. It was at a church like yours. Every night it was staffed with people and they were all church volunteers and they would monitor the facility and they would cook food and they would sleep there overnight and make sure that everybody who was sleeping at the church, you know, got in and the doors were shut when it was time to get in and shut the doors. And they got up and left when it was time to leave for the day.
Yeah.
But the only thing they required was that you pass a breathalyzer. That's it.
Yeah, fair enough.
They said, you can come in and eat, you can come in and sleep, but you got to be able to pass this breathalyzer. And I know so many people that I'd be like, hey, why don't you go over to the shelter and get a meal? Oh, you know, they're going to make me blow into that machine and not screw that. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. Okay. So what you're saying is you're more interested in getting shit faced than you are in fixing your life, getting your shit together, having a hot meal. So now I no longer feel sorry for you.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I mean, here's the other thing too, that is sad is I think with the stuff that is coming out of Sacramento, I think it's only going to get worse. You know, a lot of the legislation now, especially, you know, if you think Prop 57, AB 109, all of those issues, it's getting to where people don't even want to, I mean, people aren't even being prosecuted anymore.
Right.
Right. And now Visalia wears body cams. Body cams are great because people cannot make up stories about us anymore.
Yeah, cops didn't want to wear them at first.
Yeah.
But and what they've proved is that 99 times out of 100, the cop was telling the truth.
For sure. But on that note, there's also times when people need to be told to shut the fuck up, right? And, you know, it's like, yeah, I want to treat everybody with dignity and respect if they'll let me, right? And but when you're dealing with people that are drunk, high, crazy, gangsters, right. Yeah, think about a gangster. I'm not going to walk up and start calling some gangster sir. I'm not going to do that, right?
And he won't like it.
Yeah, yeah. No, and that's just it. You know this. It's the vernacular of the street.
Right.
Right. There's a way that I would talk to those guys. I wasn't trying to be rude, but I'd be like, hey, brother, sit down on the ground. Sit down right. on the curb. Right.
Right.
Why do I
and
need
it was a term of affection is saying by saying brother, you're like, yeah. Okay, I'm not calling you sir. I'm not trying to pretend or fake that you're this other thing, but at the same time, I'm gonna treat you with dignity, you know, yeah. and not gonna not call you a piece of shit in front of your homies.
For sure.
You know, but that's street vernacular. And
it is
a lot of those people. If you ask a parolee to please sit down and cross his legs and be quiet, he's going to look at you like your head's just exploded.
For sure.
But if you tell that same parolee to sit down and shut the fuck up and cross his ankles, he's going to be like, all right, this guy means business.
Well, yeah. And you know this, if you're truly on parole or you just got out of the joint, right? I mean, you know this. Hey, there's a way that we talk to you. And there's a way you're not going to understand, sir, please, with sugar on top, would you please sit down right here? I used to tell rookies all the time, you're acting like a rookie. And if this guy thinks you're a rookie, he's going to try to attack you, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a way of carrying yourself. And even just like this, command presence, that's a real deal. I've proven this 1,000 times. I always kept my uniforms nice and pressed. I did all my everything dry cleaned.
Right.
But when I was standing next to a guy that was out of shape, uniform just come out of the bottom of a hamper, didn't look like he had taken a shower in 3 days. He always got attacked before me. Always.
Right.
But on that note is it's like I tell people, you know, it's like new cops. There is a way to talk to people where, you know, this, they don't need to think who's in charge. They already look at you and they know you're in charge.
Some people have it innately. Some people have that presence and that ability to talk to people innately. They, you know, they come out of FTO with that ability. Some people have to be taught it, but you can learn it if you're willing to open yourself up to it. And then there's other people that will never, ever get it.
That is totally
the Rod Farvas of this world that are like, I'll call him a chicken fucker. You're like, no, that's not the joke.
Yeah. And you know what I used to tell a lot of these new guys is this. Hey, this is not a job. This is a craft. You have to beat on your craft at all times. You're always doing that next thing that's going to make you better. You know, and you know this, a lot of the trainings we go to, I don't know about you, man, but I think in my whole career, I only went to maybe a half a dozen trainings that were worth the shit, man. The rest of them were a waste of time. Did you ever get to go to the perishable skills?
Oh, the FATS training?
Yeah. So every 2 years, you got to go to this. And it's like low speed driving, a little bit of high speed driving, force option simulator. It's a total waste of time.
It's a video game.
It totally is. And it's like, I used to say this, hey, you know, I would rather go to something that's really going to be beneficial. You know, that like I see a lot of the new guys now that are all into jiu-jitsu, which is great. Because I freestyled wrestled for a lot of years. So a lot of times when I got into fights, I'd pick a guy up, body slam him on the ground, knock the breath out of him, and then get him cuffed up. You know, because all that twist wrist lock stuff that we're all taught in the academy, that stuff does not work, period.
So here's the thing. As the former instructor of all the wristy twisty stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I could tell you that, and I, as a wristy twist instructor, I went to the administration. I said, look, you have to let me work with them more. It's never going to work if it doesn't sink in, and it's never going to sink in if they don't get to practice it regularly. And I said, he said, you know, we don't shoot people all the time, but we go to the range every 3 months.
Yeah.
So you got to let me at least have every 3 months to have these people. And that's the thing. If you're not proficient with those skills, it's just going to turn into a wrestling match. And so you having a wrestling background, if that's where you're comfortable, or the jiu-jitsu guys having a jiu-jitsu background, hey, guess what? At least you're doing something, right? At least you're working outside of your career to train yourself. It's like a hockey player who goes to the gym. You know, he doesn't have to go to the gym. He can just practice skating with the team if he wants, but he's never going to get stronger and get bigger and work on those areas. You know, any athlete, football, basketball,
yeah,
you have to train outside of your career.
I totally agree. You know, it's like, I see the SWAT guys now, you know, I mean, when we were all doing it, remember they did all hard entries in the gang unit. I did hundreds of high risk search warrants.
Yep.
And I look now, the days of doing a hard entry are over, brother. Now it's this, we're going to surround the house and we're going to call you out.
Right. And we'll stay here all night.
Correct.
Right.
And it's turned in, I mean, the way of law enforcement now, I feel sorry when I see a new guy coming on now. There's just a little bit of me, man. I'm like, I appreciate the fact that you're here because we need the bodies, right? But man, for you starting out right now, I'm like, oh my God, man. I mean, if somebody told me I had to go do another 10 years, man, I'd ball my eyes.
Yeah, for sure. I wasn't ready to retire when I did.
Where did you get out?
I got out in 2013. They put me out to pasture. Okay. And so after, you know, being retired by the department, I kind of went, what the hell do I do? And I missed it for a while. Now, I mean, starting in about 2018, I just watch it get worse and worse and worse. And now I have a hard time even, before, if my son had come to me and said, I want to get into that career, I'd have been like, okay, we have to have a serious chat about it if you're ready for it, but I support you. Now I'm like, please, anything but that. Just at least until, you know, we get over this hump of fucked upness where, you know, right is wrong, wrong is right, good is evil, evil is good.
Yeah. You know? No, you know what? I tell you what, I got a 15-year-old that's drop dead gorgeous. And, you know, she was like, for years, I'm going to be a cop just like my dad. And, you know, I had to sit her down about a year ago and I said, listen, honey, I do this shit so you don't have to. And I said, you know what? Go be a nurse. Go be something where you can make good money. I said, but I don't want you dealing with, you know, just all the negativity and all the crap that comes with it. I was born to be a cop. I'm a third generation police officer. And my grandfather was the first constable of a small farming community. My dad was a bail bondsman, a private investigator, and a bounty hunter. And he would have been a cop, but he was a convicted felon and he couldn't possess a gun. But my dad, you know, and then there's me. So I know this. I was born to do this and, you know, I was really good at it and it was great. But you know this, man, at the end, there always comes this point in time where you got to tell yourself, hey, it's over. And you know what? And now let's move on to the next phase of our lives. Because, you know, it's like I could have stuck around a few more years, right? But I'm thinking, when's my time where I can start making the big bucks? Like, you know, you see your administration that's making killer dough. Hey, don't give me the bars and stars. Just give me the check. You know what I mean?
Right.
With everything now, and in fact, it's kind of funny with my PERS and my deferred compensation, I'm bringing home the same amount I was as working.
And now you can go do whatever you want.
Yeah. And now with this second gig, I'm just doing this to pay for my medical and pay for my truck because we don't have health care for retirees.
Right. Right.
And, yeah. And so, you know what? I can make a little bit of change on the side, man. Hey, all the better.
That's absolutely right. Well, we usually dedicate an episode to a fellow officer, veteran, someone we know who has paid the ultimate price, but we always give our guests a chance to dedicate their episode to whomever they like. So
yeah, I'll dedicate mine to a guy named Kent Hawes. He was a deputy sheriff with the Tulare County Sheriff's Office. And he was in the, they called it STEP, but they were kind of like, they were the SWAT team for the sheriff's office. And so when I was in the gang task force, our buildings butted up to each other and we got to do a lot of great stuff together. And he was awesome. Ultimately, he got dispatched out to the middle of nowhere, met up with a guy in an orange grove and got shot and succumbed to his injuries. It was a really sad time. And you know, this anytime that an officer loses their life, it affects so many people in so many different ways. And I remember I was in patrol when that happened, and they sent me to the hospital and they said, hey, there's gonna be a lot of deputies coming. Don't let anybody come into the hospital. Hey man, I had 15 deputies pull up into the parking lot at one time. You know what I did? Let me get the code for you. And I let them go right in because, you know, you're not going to stop them.
No.
And I remember that day so vividly. And, you know, and all of us, you know, cops are, we're pretty hard ass and we cynical in a lot of ways. But man, when his family pulled up and the wife and the kids got out of the car, man, it hit me right where I live and breathe, you know. And
that's what makes it real, that it could have been you.
For sure. And you know what? By the grace of God, you know, I mean, we've all seen so many people get shot and stabbed. And when I see an officer get hurt or injured or, you know, shot or stabbed or ran over by a car, I think in my mind, I'm like, but how did all, you know, if that's where people don't get it, we don't get paid enough to do this job, period. And then when you see people get injured or killed, it's just, it really hits hard.
Well, and that's where you say, look, I didn't get in this for the money,
yeah,
or the recognition, but yeah. I would like for the people that I protect not to spit on me or assume that I'm an evil bastard. And then I would like the administration that's supposed to have my back to actually fucking have my back. If I have those two, if cops could get those two things, you'd see a lot more people getting into this profession again, because you don't get into the money. Now, granted, there are times when the economy is in such a state that guys would be like, oh, it's a stable job with good benefits. I'm going to work, get a government job. Yeah. That is the wrong goddamn reason to get into law enforcement right there.
But you know this, law enforcement is a true calling.
Right.
Right. And it really
is a profession.
It is. And it's like, you know, I got a picture of me 5 years old on my fifth birthday and I've got a cake and it's got a cop car on top of the cake. Right. Now, through the years, you know, we all kind of, you know, as a little boy, I always wanted to be a cop. And then when I got to high school, I was like, man, I don't want to be one of those guys. And then it's kind of funny how things go full circle. And it was always in the back of my mind, hey, I think I could do that. I think I could be good at that. And, you know, I can tell you this is we, and I know this, you can attest to this, how many guys that came into this job that just went, you know what? This is not what I thought it was going to be.
And more power to them.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's what I should tell people is this. Hey, if this is not your bag, amen, then go, brother. Because this right here is, we're dealing with life and death. You know what I mean? We're wearing guns. And, you know, you can go flip burgers or whatever it is that you want to do. But this is truly, with law enforcement, it's not a job. Yeah. It's a calling. It's a lifestyle.
As far as men go, men and women, as far as a person who comes to me and says, this is not what I thought it was going to be. I need to do something else. I'm not cut out for this. I'll respect you as a person a lot more than somebody who is secretly scared or in this job for the wrong reasons and doesn't get out because they don't want to look chicken shit or, you know, their ego won't let them. Dude, if you're not cut out for this job, just get out. If, you know, I just totally get out. You're protecting the citizens, you're protecting the city, and you're protecting your fellow officers by getting out. So, Deputy Hawes, we dedicate this episode to you. Rest easy, brother. We got it from here. Jay, I appreciate you coming on. I'm sorry Adam couldn't be with us, but I want to have him come on again to tell us his second story about his other shooting. But we'd be more than happy to have you back as well. Hey, I know you've got a ton of stories. We didn't even get it. You know, we got a little story out of you, but we didn't even get into some of your other stories because we were so busy talking about you know, what the hell is wrong with the cops these days?
Yeah, with the job. I can tell you this. I got 1,001 stories, man. And if you guys ever want to have me back on, I would love to. I'm one of those guys I'm sure you could see, but if you let me, I'll talk your ear off, bro.
All right. Well, until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.